This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the book titled Another Tucson, written by Bonnie Henry and published in 1992. This chapter is entitled That Western Flavor, Article Number 2, Multaqua and Riata Racetracks. This chapter is entitled Tell Me You Remember, Article Number 4, Western Union. World War II may have bequeathed us the ballpoint pen, and space exploration may have endowed us with Tang, but credit the Apache with giving us this town's first instant communications link with the outside world. It is finished, came the message, dotting and dashing its way across the telegraph wire strung between Tucson and San Diego on December 2, 1873, just minutes after the last pole was put in place. The iron string, the Apaches called it, this strange wire ordered up by their nemesis, General George S. Crook, as a way for Arizona's army post to keep tabs on the Indian. Congressional appropriation for the task, $50,311, a sum so meager that poles had to be strung out 17 to the mile, according to a 1923 Tucson Citizen article. As a result, the article goes on to say, cacti and mesquite were freely used in the construction. By the publication date of that article, Indian attacks were the stuff of old-timers' daydreams. Now it was the civilians who were doing much of the communicating, over the wires of Western Union, 18 East Congress Street. And that's where the office stood in the 1940s when Irene Sutherland and Ruth Burns went to work during the waning months of World War II. Just as it was in the 1870s, war was still good for the telegraph business, but not necessarily good for those on the receiving end of a telegram. The hardest were the casualty messages, remember Sutherland, who started working at the Western Union counter in 1944. At that time, Western Union messengers delivered by car, foot, bicycle, and scooter. Western Union never closed, says Sutherland. We worked 12-hour shifts many a day. Down the street, at 16 West Congress, stood Western Union's competition for a few years, known as the Postal Telegraph Company. So busy were they, recounts a 1942 newspaper article, that the company was actively recruiting female messengers. In 1945, with her job at Consolidated Volte Aircraft Corporation winding down, Ruth Burns went to work for Western Union, cutting and gluing taped messages. Sometimes at Christmas time, the tape would pile up a couple of feet high, says Burns. You weren't really reading the telegrams. You were just checking the spelling. Some Morse code was still being used back then. All the radio stations used it, says Burns. We had about 4 Morse code operators when I first went to work. Then they had to learn the teletype. She still remembers time spent working the teletype machine. I used to work the graveyard shift. I think I made about 45 cents an hour. Messages, says Burns, were charged by the word. We had some people who would use very large words, she recalls. Others saved their money by sending messages after 8 p.m. through what Burns calls night letters. One man who claimed to be a movie producer in Hollywood used to send reams and reams of words to this young girl who lived in a small town near here. They would be pages and pages long, saying how he was going to make her a star. Though telegrams and money orders were the bulk of its business, Western Union was not above the gimmick, particularly after widespread telephone service started cutting into the need for telegrams. One such gimmick was the candygram. We kept a big freezer full of candy, 1 or 2 pound boxes, remembers Sutherland. But sometimes we had to struggle with hot weather. If no one was home and the messengers couldn't deliver it, the candy sometimes came back melted, and we couldn't use it again. The beginning of the end for Western Union's local office started when a huge central bureau was built in Reno, says Burns. Rates also went up, and the company started charging extra for messenger delivery. Still, even when the local office at 10 East Broadway closed down in 1984, among its skeleton staff, all with more than 20 years' service, were two messengers. "We were still handling some death messages," Sutherland explains. "Some people had no telephone or had an unlisted telephone number." Today, Western Union operates locally through agents in businesses ranging from truck stops to restaurants. Burns, who retired as office manager when the local Western Union office closed down in 1984, refuses to wax sentimental over the demise of the telegram. "No, I don't miss it one bit," she says. "We were pooped out." Subarticle. Rudy Lopez. The uniform was wool, the tips meager, and the bike his own. Western Union messenger boy. This was the life Rudy Lopez lived from 1937 to 1940. It is a life gone the way of the iceman, the elevator operator, and the movie house usherette. "I started when I was 14. I quit school. There were a lot of boys working there. I thought it was neat as hell. Most of the boys were Mexican boys. I only remember one gringo." Western Union supplied the uniforms, wool pants, drab-colored shirt and jacket, black tie, olive cap. You could wear the shirt without the jacket in the summer. Then we had these leather coverings that went from below our knees down to our shoes. We had to keep our shoes shined all the time. They were nice, soft leather high tops. We bought them from Western Union. We had our lockers in the back, showers, too. We'd change there, leave our uniforms. They laundered them for us. They even furnished us with a raincoat, a rain cap, and those things that go over your shoes. What do you call them? Galoshes? I bought my first bicycle, a Greyhound, from Russell and Shepherd. I paid them $1 a month. They trusted us. Can you imagine a 14-year-old boy being trusted like that? We'd go pick up money orders. I remember going down to Sabino Alley, and the women working down there would give us money to send out of state. Here were all these rolls of bills, but they were all $1 bills. By the time I went into the Arizona National Guard in 1940, Western Union was paying us 20 cents an hour. But when I started, it was a rate on the zone. They'd pay so much for each telegram. The farthest I went was to El Conquistador. I thought nothing of going from there to the university, then to the VA hospital. St. Mary's was as far as I went to the west. Our caps had our ID numbers on them. As soon as you were through, you parked your bike in the rack out front and put your cap on the counter to be the one for the next route. Sure, I delivered lots of death messages. They had red stars on them, for priority. The birthday messages we had to sing. I tried not to get those. We delivered a lot of packages, too. We'd strap them around our shoulders. In 1939, I decided to go back to school, so I got a night route that went from about 3:30 in the afternoon to 10:45. Once, I delivered a telegram to General Pershing when he was staying at El Conquistador. Sometimes we'd get tips. If you got a dime, it was really something. I had money in my pocket all the time. When they finally put us in by the hour, I was making $7 a week. Oh boy, I had it made. Article number 5, Hot Rodders. The track didn't seem to matter much. City streets or desert trails, cornfields or ground better suited to the pounding of horses' hooves. Just so the tires stayed on and the engine ran sweet. This was early auto racing in Tucson. As you listen to those fearsome engines roar through another Indianapolis 500 in May, know this. Tucson's first official auto race occurred the same year as the first 500-miler at Indy. And both happened on tracks called Speedway. Tucson's came on the first day of 1911, when thousands turned out in bitter chill to watch a field of daredevils roar around the desert on a makeshift dirt track. We now call that track Speedway, Wilmot Road, Broadway, and First Avenue. Airborne tires sliced through the crowds as racers competed for prize money that ranged from $5 to $100. The event was such a success, reported to the next day's Star, that the Tucson Automobile Club gave the visiting auto men a smoker at the Old Pebble Club. New Year's Day, 1915, was equally thrilling, as the eight fastest automobiles in the Southwest vied for $1,000 in prize money in a 100-mile race at the new fairgrounds, not far from where Keno Hospital stands today. Three times that day, trains departed from the old El Paso and Southwestern station downtown, carrying spectators out to the racetrack, so far from town. The winner was Dick Clark, driving Harold Steinfeld's Stutz Racer 102 miles in a dizzying 1 hour, 53 minutes, 13 seconds. Like the rest of the drivers, Clark ferried his own mechanic throughout the race. The mechanics, by the way, usually eased themselves into a prone position during the race to lessen wind resistance. By the late 40s, the roar of the engines had moved north of town, across the street from Gilpin Airlines on Romero Road. Walter Douglas Jr. made a racetrack right in the middle of a cornfield, and about 60 of us formed the Tucson Auto and Cycle Racing Association, says Bill Cheeseborg. Long a racing fixture in this town, Cheeseborg is a veteran of two mini, two-count midget, sprint, and stock car competitions, as well as seven Indy 500s. But back in the late 40s, he was just another 20-year-old with a twitchy foot on the gas pedal. "I got my first car when I was 11, says Cheeseborg, a Tucson native. "I sold a donkey for $11, then I bought a Model T for $7. Then I had to go back and borrow the donkey to tow the car home." By the time he was 16, Cheeseborg was driving a Model A and racking up 27 tickets for speeding and reckless driving, mainly for drag racing in front of Tucson High School. It took a $1,000 win on a dirt track at Kinsley's Ranch in 1947 to show him how to turn a fast buck out of things that go vroom. The truck Cheeseborg and the rest of the jalopy jockeys raced at Gilpin was quarter mile in dirt. Payoff was maybe $50 to $75, tops. Though he once raced and won at Gilpin in his mother's car, Cheeseborg's favorite to race was a 39 three-window Ford coupe. "We'd go around town, in alleys, behind people's houses, looking for the cars we wanted. Then we'd try to talk them into selling their cars. Get 'em and gut 'em. That's what we did." Under the hood of these gutless wonders yammered a V8 engine. "Most everybody used what they called a flathead Ford," says Roger McCluskey, another local boy who made good at the racetrack. 18-time veteran of the Indy 500 and winner of several national championships, McCluskey used to roar around Gilpin in a 37 Ford coupe, or a resemblance of one. During the early 50s, the car racers moved south to the present-day rodeo grounds. By that time, Cheeseborg and McCluskey had picked up the nicknames Wild Bill and Old Leadfoot, though their speeds, say Cheeseborg, rarely exceeded 50 miles per hour at Gilpin. The pace picked up considerably at the rodeo grounds. "In those days, it was a place to race, and we just thought it was great," says McCluskey, who still has the first check he earned at a racetrack. All 91 cents. Races at the rodeo grounds usually ran on Saturday nights, sometimes Sunday afternoons, on a quarter-mile dirt track. When they had the rodeo, it always tore up the track, so they'd have to put it back every year, says Cheeseborg. Out of a field of 50 to 60 cars, says Cheeseborg, 8 or 10 were capable of winning each race. The rodeo grounds was probably one of the toughest competitions any place in the Southwest. Time trials, heat races, and trophy runs all took place in one night or afternoon. There was no pit, no pit crews. We trailered our cars in, ready to race, says Cheeseborg. He remembers the time all the cars, save his, rammed through the adobe wall south of the racetrack and piled onto Irvington Road. Mine just rolled over. Both Cheeseborg and McCleskey remember the night they lost a good friend on the track, a racer named Johnny Dye. He was hit and his head hit the roof of the car, says Cheeseborg. I helped them take him out of the car. I knew then he was dead. He wasn't moving. We went on with the race. Early safety measures were haphazard at best. Seat belts but no harnesses, car doors chained shut, and an odd progression of helmets. Sometimes we'd race in our old high school football helmets made out of leather, says Cheeseborg, who wore the standard racer's outfit, T-shirt, Levi's, and surplus combat boots, left over from World War II. Today, the cornfield-turned-racetrack on Romero Road is covered with industry, and the rodeo grounds is just that, period. Wild Bill, an old Leadfoot, no longer make a living burning rubber. Cheeseborg, who's built race cars for decades, contents himself with rooting for others at the track. I still help out the races. Somebody helped me when I was a kid, says Cheeseborg, but I sold my last race car and planted a garden. Article 6. Hudgkin's Air Service. Their planes range from biplanes to helicopters. Their passengers from corpses to bank robbers. Their battles from forest fires to red tape. Take a passel of brothers, plop them down in Tucson's fledgling aviation client of 1938, and watch them take off. 50 years later, is there a person in town who knows what an airplane is who doesn't know the name Hudgkin? In 1988, they finally shut it down for good. Hudgkin Air Service is no more. Bought out by the growing airport next door. An airport that was nothing but cactus and coyotes when the second Hudgkin hangar in town went up back in 1941. We scraped off a piece of the desert for the runway while the city was building the airfield. Al and I and another fellow who was working for Al. Then we built the hangar, says Palin Hudgkin, younger brother to Al, the first in the family to fly. Flashback to 1927. That was the year that Al, third oldest in a family of five brothers and one sister, learned to fly from a barnstormer putting on a show in the Hudgkins' hometown of Nogales. Incidentally, the father of all this clan was once mayor of Nogales. Before long, Al was the proud owner of an old Eagle Rock biplane and was teaching the folks in Nogales how to fly. That is, when he wasn't working in the laundry of a nearby army post. In 1937, Al quit the laundry job for good. The next year, he moved to Tucson. In 1938, Davis-Monthan was a military and civilian airport, so Al leased a hangar from the city of Tucson next to the military hangar, says Palin, who would join his brother the following year in the new venture. By then, of course, Palin had learned to fly from Al and was now teaching others. We did charter and instruction, he says. Meanwhile, younger brother Henry, who also learned to fly from Al while still in high school in Nogales, would drive up to Tucson in his old battered car on the weekends to help out. Although American Airlines would use the airbase until 1947, gathering war clouds forced other civilians to vacate the premises in 1941. The military took over the airbase and all the civilians had to leave, says Palin. The city was going to build an airfield south of town, so that's where we went. But not for long. Once war was declared, civilian operations ceased at the new airport, too, says Palin. So the Hudgkin brothers leased their hangar to the new neighbors, Consolidated Volte, a gigantic aircraft company plant. Al, in fact, became a test pilot and later chief of flight operations for the Tucson plant. After the war, the brothers were eager, naturally, to reopen their business. But the corporations, whose duty it was to dispose of militarized properties around the country, seemed to be mired in red tape. "We owned the hangar, but the gates were locked and we couldn't get in," says Henry. Finally, Al said, "Come on, we're going to open for business." We took a hacksaw over to the gate and threw the lock over the railroad tracks. The years that followed were busy ones for the Hudgkins. Brother Walter became a mechanic for the company, and in the early 50s, eldest brother Luis joined up and also earned his wings. The company sold airplanes, ran air freight, and offered charter service. One customer who chartered a plane still stands out in the pilot's memory. "The guy had robbed a bank in Douglas, and then he took a cab from Nogales to Tucson," remembers Palin, who was the unknowing pilot. "He wanted to fly to Las Vegas, but when he tried to find his money, he got in a panic. Then he realized he had left it in Nogales. So we went back in the cab to Nogales, got the money, and came back. Just after we took off, the sheriff arrived and told Al to get on the radio and call us back." Al said, "I'm not going to do that. That guy might have a gun." "When we got to Las Vegas, here came the police to arrest him," says Palin, who emerged from the incident unscathed. During the mid-50s, Henry ferried even more dangerous cargo. "We were asked by a cousin of ours, who was a pilot at American Airlines, to transport this radioactive material from Maine to San Diego," he recalls. "American wouldn't do it, so our cousin thought of us. He said we would fly anything." The brothers rigged up a brand new Piper with a 25-foot plastic boom attached to its tail. Attached to the boom was a nylon cord that stretched out 175 feet. And dangling at the end of the cord was the radioactive material, which was then reeled in to the end of the boom during takeoffs and landings. The plane, minus a radio to ensure privacy, made five stops across the country to refuel, including one in Pittsburgh during a near blizzard. "When we got to San Diego, they studied the radioactive material for a few minutes and then dropped it down a deep well and buried it," says Henry. Accompanying him on the flight was a scientific sort who carried a Geiger counter. "Despite flying the material no closer than 25 feet to the airplane," says Henry, "that airplane became so radioactive it sent the Geiger counter needle clear off. But so far, I felt no ill effects." From 1950 to 1969, the Hudgkins also ran Grand Canyon Airlines, swooping tourists under the rim. During one such scenic flight, Henry's plane engine stopped cold, and he had to glide the plane down to a Colorado River sandbar. "The passengers thought it was part of the ride," he says, laughing. The brothers also ran an ambulance service, ferrying patients around the country. "We transported bodies, too," says Palin, remembering one memorable trip that he piloted between Yuma and Tucson, accompanied by a corpse and a local mortician. "This woman wasn't in a body bag. She was just under a sheet," says Palin. Midway through the flight, the mortician, says Palin, decided to drape the lady's arms around the pilot as a joke. Taking to the skies has always been a family affair for the Hudgkins. Henry first met his future wife, Ellen, as her night instructor. All three of their sons have worked in the family business. Palin, too, taught his wife, Margaret, to fly. And Jean Rourke, the brother's lone sister, has four sons who all fly. Adding them up, Palin says, "I guess we had 16 Hudgens flying at one time." Sadly, that number was diminished by one in July of 1961, when Al Hudgkin died in the crash of his helicopter atop Agassiz Peak, north of Flagstaff. "He landed on this big slab of rock and shut down the engine," says Palin. "There was a vibration. Part of the rock dropped off, and the copter slid down and caught on fire. The business, of course, carried on for another 27 years. In fact, says Henry, It was going great guns right up to the end. The Tucson Airport Authority wanted our property, and we couldn't sell the business to someone else when they knew they were going to have to move. So they sold the dozen planes they still owned, saw that most of their 25 employees found other jobs, and then sold or gave away just about everything else. This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.